Welcome to The Point. I'm Mindy Todd. Today we talk about memoir and tools to help us put our stories to paper. Later in the hour, Nancy Sloan Amirani joins us. Her latest book is 7 Secrets to the Perfect Personal Essay, Crafting the Story Only You Can Write. But first we talk with Cynthia Blakely. She's an instructor of memoir at Emory University. Her recently published memoir is The Innermost House. Cynthia, welcome.
Thank you.
So you were raised in Wellfleet, surrounded by generations of immediate and extended family, yet there was a lot about your parents' past, particularly your mother's, that remained a mystery. So tell us a little bit about your mother.
My mother was a very charismatic, artistic, generous person, but she had gone through an abusive first marriage that lasted for over 10 years. And I think that she suffered from what social scientists would call, you know, complex post-traumatic stress syndrome. And so she had a lot of emotional ups and downs. I don't think she was manic depressive by any stretch, but certainly she had an inner intensity that came out in her artistic projects, in her socializing. But she didn't like to talk about that first marriage. She talked a lot about her growing up in Lowell, Tewksbury, Massachusetts, right on the Lowell-Tewksbury line. But I never knew anything, for example, about how my parents met or even when they got married. And so I felt but couldn't articulate the presence of secrets. And as an adult, trying to understand my own life and the effects of growing up in this family, I started interviewing my mother and other people and really began to discover and shape a family history that both helped me to feel more grounded in my own past, but also freed me from some of the confusing over-identification with my mother that I felt, or just plain old confusion about my family's past.
Your father doesn't figure prominently in your memoir. Why?
Well, he does in that chapter on my dream life of him. He died when I was 15. I was pretty much frightened of him most of my life. And I used to have a lot of dreams about him in which I was scared of him. But as I worked on this memoir and spoke to relatives, I began to question my own view of my father because other people had very different views. And what I learned through that is not that my own experience of my father was not true, but that there were many true versions of him. And I needed to loosen the narrative a little bit to accept the fact that other people had different experiences of my father. And while I was doing that, my dream life changed and I began to have many more positive dreams of him. And so it was this really interesting experience of actually continuing the relationship over a couple of decades through my dream life. And I'm personally very interested in dreams and wrote my dissertation on dreams. So this was a wonderful way to begin to talk about and actually reclaim the positive aspects of that relationship.
The first scene in your memoir occurs when your mother is pregnant with you. Two police officers arrive at the door, one of which your mother knows personally, and they're there to arrest your mother. What were the events that led up to this moment?
Well, it was actually my mother's husband and the chief of police who were at the door. And the events that led up to that was that my mother and her first husband were separated. He was living in Germany with a German woman. They hadn't seen each other for about 2 years. And my mother was desperate for a divorce. She was in love with my father who lived next door. And he wanted to marry her. And she became pregnant with me by my father who lived next door. And she begged her husband for a divorce. And he kept refusing to grant her a divorce. And so finally she wrote him this letter listen, I'm pregnant. Please just give me a divorce. Robert wants to marry me. We'll take care of the children. You don't need to pay child support, nothing. Just give me a divorce. And instead of responding to that letter, her first husband flew to the United States, went to the chief of police, Frank Davenport, who was a friend of my mother's, and said, I want my wife arrested for adultery. And so they showed up at my mother's doorstep, and she was arrested for adultery. And Charlie Frazier, who was basically the boss in Wellfleet during that period, selectman, lawyer, town council, owned huge amounts of acreage. My mother's first husband got Charlie Frazier as his lawyer. And so my mother was put on public trial in Provincetown for the crime of adultery and was convicted and sentenced to 3 months in the Barnstable House of Corrections. And her first husband used this conviction then to gain custody of two of the four children that they had together.
It's, I mean, shocking when you think about it, right? I mean, just
completely.
Yeah, yeah. So why did you want to start your memoir at this moment?
Because in some ways, it's my earliest memory, even though I can't remember it. But what I talk about in that chapter is how what happens when you are in the womb has an effect on your development outside of the womb. And I've found all the science behind that really interesting and helpful in allowing me to process it. But it's also because I had a sense growing up that my mother had had a really painful, difficult first marriage, and I didn't know anything about it. And that chapter is therefore called Impossible Memories. I can't cognitively remember what happened when my mother was pregnant with me. But as I argue in that chapter, my body holds its traces. It had an effect. And then the secrets surrounding all that, because I did not learn about that arrest until I was 40 years old. Mm. My mother kept it a very well-guarded secret. No one ever talked about it. I had no idea it had happened.
Of course, this was a different time, but it's still so shocking to read how your mother was treated right here on Cape Cod. What role, if any, do you think place had in how the law was applied to your mother?
I'm not sure if place had an effect so much as the political ambitions of Charlie Frazier, who went on shortly after that trial to become an assistant attorney general of the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, and Judge Welsh, who was the second of the three Judge Welshes, who was, you know, Catholic, very attached to a sense of a moral code. I think that particular constellation of forces basically doomed my mother in that courtroom.
Yeah. You kept journals. Can you explain why you started keeping journals and how you used them as you were writing this book?
I kept journals. I started keeping journals because of my beloved elementary school, Wellfleet Elementary School English teacher, Barbara Winslow, who assigned them to us when we were in fifth grade. And I took to it like a fish to water. I loved writing in that journal. And so I had Mrs. Winslow for 2 years and kept up the journal keeping and did so for the rest of my life, basically. Mm-hmm. And those journals were incredibly helpful in reconstructing parts of my childhood. I didn't like to read the ones from middle school and high school later on because it was painful. It was painful to revisit some of those scenes. But on the other hand, I also was in some ways corrected by my own journals because I would think back to my past and I'd think, oh, my mother's drinking. She became an alcoholic. It was so horrible. It was very hard. And I go back and even during those years, I have so many moments of happiness. I had a great education at Nauset Regional High School. I had a wonderful elementary school. And there was a lot of joy in those journals that I think I skipped over in my head a lot when I was rethinking my past. And so, as a way, as an archive, those journals kind of corrected my later construction of the past. It didn't change it. It just amended it in a way that became much more positive. But a lot of material comes from those journals. I'm not sure I would have been able to write the memoir, certainly not in the way that it came out, had I not had those journals. And had I not had my sister, Thelma, and my cousin, Holly, who have fabulous memories for our shared childhood. Let me tell you, I really believe that autobiographical memory is a co-constructed affair because other people help us to remember.
Yeah, so talk about that. Did you talk with your siblings about them as you were writing it? And if so, how did they feel about you revealing details of your family life?
Well, I mostly spoke to one sibling, my sister Thelma Blakely, who is the most wonderful person. And I don't know how she felt, but she was completely kind and generous in helping me to remember things like the make of the stove in our old kitchen, or Holly, for example, would help me to remember the songs that we sang as we walked down the railroad bed to Duck Pond to go swimming in the summers. And I would say my cousin Holly, my cousin Richard was enormously helpful, and my sister Thelma were the three relatives, besides my mother and grandmother, of course, who contributed the most to reconstructing that childhood and correcting it. It was really my cousin Richard who said, you know, he would call me Cindy, you know, Cindy, I really think you've got things a little backwards when it comes to your father. I loved your father. And so he was critical in helping me to rethink that relationship with more honesty, to be honest. Because I think I was invested in a certain version that served the way I wanted to think about it. And he's like, you know, aren't you not remembering really all these other wonderful things? And so he was very helpful too.
You include notes at the end of the book. Talk more about the purpose of these endnotes.
Well, because thinking about the way autobiographical memory works, why we remember, why we forget, how we curate the past was really important for me to understand my own story. I wanted to back this up with the social science and the neuroscience on memory and trauma, for example, trauma in the brain. And I wanted to provide a resource for readers who might want to think about this more, not academically, but in a more organized and reliable fashion. So it's not just me saying these things. The comments that I make about autobiographical memory, about forgetting, about the effect of trauma on the brain, this comes from social and neuroscience. And I want readers to have confidence in what I'm saying about the psychology and neuroscience of memory. So that's one of the reasons I have the notes. But then there's also historical background that I don't want to weigh down the text with too much of this kind of factual background. So the notes are for people who want to know more or who might want to be pointed to the science of what I'm trying to communicate.
In a few minutes, we'll be talking about writing our personal stories. But as someone who's not just written a memoir, but teaches writing, what thoughts would you have to leave with listeners about writing about themselves and family?
Writing can be incredibly helpful to organizing your own story in your head. And sometimes it can have short-term negative effects because the really painful stuff is disruptive. But the long-term effects, again, social science tells us this, is really positive. And so, particularly when it comes to trauma, narrativizing trauma helps us to organize it and to become the author of our experience rather than just the object of someone else's violence or cruelty or unkind treatment. So, in that sense, it can be life-changing to write one's own story. I think the important thing is to try to keep as honest and reliable as you can. This is something I worked incredibly hard at, which is why I interviewed so many people for this memoir, including lawyers and selectmen and policemen and everyone, and looked into the archives and really tried to triangulate in a historical way the story that I was telling. But writing can be very healing, and it can help you to let go of, or not to let go of, but almost to forget things that you might want to forget. It's a funny relationship. It allows you to remember and it allows you to let go because you don't ruminate as much anymore. So I encourage people to do this. The one thing, if you're aiming for publication, to remember is just because it happened to you doesn't make it really interesting. You have to create meaning out of what you experienced. And it's that creation of meaning that is going to connect to your reader.
Cynthia Blakely's memoir is The Innermost House. We'll post a link with information at our website, capeandislands.org. Cynthia, thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Coming up after break, Nancy Sloan Amerini joins us to talk about her latest book, Seven Secrets to the Perfect Personal Essay. Stay with us.